Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein with a responsum a day for the 9th of Sivan. Today's tshuva, today's responsum, comes from Shut Mishpatei Uziel, from the response of Rabin Zion Meir Chai Uziel, who was the chief rabbi, the Sephardic chief rabbi of both Palestine and then the State of Israel when it was founded. This is from his shut in the fourth volume in the Choshen Mishpat section, Siman Lamed Bet, the 32nd responsum. It was written on the 9th of Sivan, of Tough Reish Tzadi Zain, 1937, a reminder that for all that the Jewish community flourished and grew tremendously from that time till the state, and certainly since the state has been founded, there was already an active Jewish community in Israel at the time. And he was asked a question by a local rabbi in a business area of Tel Aviv, where a man had gotten divorced from his wife. Sadly, when people get divorced, they don't always act as well as we would like them to. And in this situation, the husband and the wife, the former wife, the former husband, were fighting over financial issues. The part of the divorce settlement was that the husband was supposed to support the wife and their daughter. And during the marriage, the husband had given a gift to this wife. The gift he had given was some kind of a real estate, and it was like a rental property. It was a kind of a thing where she could make money off of it. And so he claimed that he had already taken care of her because the property he had given her was sufficient to provide the support that he owed. And she said, well, that was a gift you gave me during the course of the marriage that's irrelevant now to the question of whether you're required to support me and how you support me. So the question is, what is the extent of the gift that he's given her? Now, in answering that question, first, Rav Uziel points out that the rabbi who had asked him the question had, as rabbis often do, in the course of the asking the question, presented his understanding. And I think part of the reason rabbis do that is because they want to say, it's not that I'm a total ignoramus, I don't understand the issue at all, I'm just checking with you. So the rabbi asking the question had presented his view, and Rav Uziel, as he often does, says, and I'm only answering now, not that you need me, of course, but since you asked me, I am responding to your request, and I am offering you my answer. So here's what I have to say. Now, we're going to now look at the Gemaras and the Rishonim. We're going to talk about how gifts are given in Halacha and what people mean by the gifts and the way they give them. Part of what's important to know about this is that, as we'll see here as well, when a Gemara says something about financial issues, that's what the Gemara says is our general assumption. Rarely does the Gemara mean it must be this way. Most often in monetary matters, it means this is how we assume it's supposed to go, unless there are other conditions made between the parties to the situation. So we'll come back to that for our particular case with this ex-husband and wife by the end, but it's just a preliminary thing to keep in mind that what we're going to first talk about is the way the Gemara assumes financial transactions go. So there's a Gemara in Bava Batra on Daf Nun Aleph, which says, Hamokhir Sadeli Ishto Kanta. If somebody sells a field to his wife during the course of their marriage, she owns it, it's a valid sale, meaning it's not true that property of hers really becomes his and things like that. But V'habal Ochel Peirot, the husband gets the peirot, he gets the profits off of it. So in a field, it's actual literal peirot. But this is true of, it was true in the time of the Gemara, of much of the property of the wife. It would become what's called nechse milog. Nechse milog is property where the property is still owned by the wife, but for the course of the marriage, the profits go to the husband. And that's a whole discussion in the Gemara about why that works. And again, it's true in the Gemara because that's the way the Gemara says it. If people make a different condition in our times, that could be a whole different situation. But that's the Gemara's assumption. So if he sells her a field, it becomes like Nechse Milog. He sold it to her to the extent that she now owns the property, but he will get whatever profits come from it. So if it's a field, the produce. If it's a rental property, the rent, things like that. More relevant to our situation, the Gemara goes on to say, Bimatana, when it comes to a gift, Kanta, she has taken possession of it, Ve'ein Habal Ochel Perot, and the husband does not get the profits and the produce. To explain, there were two opinions that Rav Uziel starts with. The Rashbam explains on that Gemara that the Baal doesn't get the peirot because there's a concept in halacha, this is a general concept, that notain ba'ayin yafahu notain. That when somebody gives a gift, they mean to give it in a very full way, in an open way. Ayin yafah means with a good eye, meaning you give the gift as full as you can. So if the husband's giving a gift, but he's actually taking all the profits and the products for the course of the marriage, that's not really such a full gift. That's the way the Rashbam understands it. And that will have ramifications we'll get to in a second. Rabbeinu Yehonatan explained that where he sells her the land, she could have made any conditions she wanted to make. It's a sale. She's paying money. So in a sale, the two parties have the freedom to put any conditions on the sale they want to. So if she knows that in general property she owns, he takes the profits, he takes the produce, when she's buying land from him here, if she had wanted it to be different, she could have just said, well, in this case, I want to take possession of it and I'm paying you for it on the condition that you don't get the peirot. But when it comes to a gift, Rabbeinu Yehonatan says, she doesn't really have that freedom. And she doesn't really have that freedom because it's a gift. So, you know, when you're receiving a gift, to then say, well, I want to put a condition on the gift is a little inappropriate. So Rabbeinu Yehonatan says, the husband doesn't get the peirot because we assume that maybe she doesn't want to get the peirot and was just too embarrassed to say it. So those are two ways of looking at it. Rav Uziel says a distinction between the two ways of looking at this is that according to the Rashbam, we can say that even though we say that gift givers, people giving gifts, do it bi'ayin yafa, they do it generously and open-handedly, that doesn't have to mean, or it doesn't make sense to mean, that would be better than other property that she has. Meaning if you want to say that he's giving her a gift and therefore giving it fully and that means that he won't get the peirot, okay, so that's already better than other property she has in some ways, but not that it's going to be anything more than the chesed milog. And therefore, the Rashbam says, for all that he doesn't get the peirot, the actual produce, the actual rent or produce or profits, it's not that she gets them fully. Rather, Rashbam would hold, it seems, according to the Rabbeinu Uziel says, Rashbam would hold, you would use that money, that's really now her money. So in other words, let's say she has, let's make it a field, and she sells, and there are apples in the field. So we sell the apples, and we make a profit of $1,000. So one option is the husband gets $1,000. Another option is the wife gets $1,000, but Rav Uziel is saying that according to Rashbam, what really should happen is that with those $1,000, you'll buy something that will also produce profits. And in that new thing, she'll own it, and there the husband will get the profits. The distinction being, though, that if he then dies or divorces her, she gets that as well. In other words, in her ordinary semi-log or ordinary property that he gets the profits, if it's an apple field and there's a $1,000 profit, he just gets it, right? In this case, what we're saying is that that $1,000 will be used to buy something else, let's say another tree, another apple tree, or another whatever it is, and then those apples he would get for the duration of their marriage. That's what Rishbam would seem to think. Whereas for Rabbeinu Yehonatan, where the question is, what did she mean, and what do we assume about her because she's too embarrassed to say it because she's getting a gift? He would seem to think that no, she gets it completely. And when we say that the Baal doesn't get the peirot, that the husband doesn't get the profits, that means that she gets it right away. She would get that $1,000 straight up. That would seem to be, according to Rav Uziel, this machloket Rishonim. He thinks also that the Ravid, that we will not go into, but he thinks the Ravid agrees with Rabbeinu Yehonatan, which, not to be too historical about it, but makes some sense because they're both Provençal scholars. So maybe the opinion in Provence was that she gets it completely, whereas Rashbam seems to think that she gets it in the sense of the profits become hers, and then those can be used as regular nechsei milog. Discussing this issue a little bit after that, the Tosfot had a discussion where Rabbeinu Tam said, in fact, that even though the Baal doesn't get the peirot, he says, "Mikol makom in karka hamatana chashuv kinyana shel haisha." The land of the gift is not really completely hers, in the sense that Rabbeinu Tam says, "This is a whole another issue, right? One issue was who gets the profits. We have an apple orchard, an apple grove, orchard, whatever apples grow in. One question is whether the husband gets the $1,000 that comes off of the year. We said Rashbam says the husband doesn't get it, but he gets it in the sense of that $1,000 will go to buy more something that produces profits, and he'll get those profits. Rabbeinu Tam said, no, she gets the $1,000. Leave that aside for a second. Rabbeinu Tam says she cannot sell or gift this field. That to that extent, she's not the owner of it. In other words, Rabbeinu Tam thinks that whether or not the husband has given the gift to her in the full sense of he's not going to get the profits directly, he certainly did not mean, Rabbeinu Tam holds, that he gave it to her in the sense that she can do whatever she wants with it, such as in selling it to somebody else or gifting it to somebody else. Whereas Ri holds that, Ri holds that what we meant by that she doesn't really own it fully is that when it comes to the profits, going back to the profits for a second, even though the husband doesn't get them, she's not, he says exactly Rashbam's idea that the Rav Uziel said, she buys a field, and from that second field, or that second orchard, the husband gets the profits. What, either way, Rav Uziel says that when a husband gives his wife a gift, she's not getting it completely. She's getting it more than her ordinary nechsei milog, where the direct profits go to the husband, but she's not getting it completely. That being said, there's one psak at the Shulchan Aruch that seems to follow that point of view. The Shulchan Aruch writes, "Baal shenatan matana l'ishto." If a husband gives a gift to his wife, she has taken possession of it. He doesn't get the pirot. He doesn't get the profits, but she can't sell the field, sell the item, or give it to somebody else. And what you do with the pirot is you buy things, and then you'll buy new land, and he'll get the profits from that land. So, in other words, the Shulchan Aruch and the rabbi who was writing Rav Uziel had been bothered by this. The Shulchan Aruch seems to paskin both like Rabbeinu Tam and like the Ri. He seems to follow both points of view, whereas Tosfot seems to see them as debating. So Rav Uziel says it's not true. They're not debating at all. They're pointing out two different ways in which, even though we say that when a man gives a gift, when a person gives a gift, they give it b'ayin yafa, they give it generously and open-handedly, it doesn't mean that he gave it completely, fully, and these are just two examples of that. So for Rav Uziel's reading, tells it it's offering two different ways to look at the fact that she's not quite the full owner of it. And if that's true, that when we say that when he gives it b'ayin yafa, he didn't mean to make it completely hers in that full way, then he says that makes sense, and Rav Yonatan is the one that he thinks doesn't make so much sense, because Rav Yonatan seems to think that it's all about what she meant when she accepted it. Whereas with gift giving, we would generally assume that what he meant was an important piece of it, and we generally think that what people were thinking internally doesn't make that much difference. It's what we assume they meant, and here we assume that he meant not to give it completely, fully. There's one more complication, though, from a discussion in the Rush that we'll see in a second. The Rush is something that also is ruled, the Beis Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, accepts this ruling. So we'll see it in the Shulchan Aruch first and then go back to the Rush. Shulchan Aruch writes that if the husband gives a gift to the wife, then even somebody who lent her money after she got married, so after she got married, knows that she's already married and that her property is really subject to her husband's control in some senses, whatever senses is true in that particular time and year and place, nonetheless can collect the loan from this kind of gift. Which is odd because we just said a second ago that it seems to be accepted that when a husband gives a gift to his wife, for all that we say, he gives it b'ayin yafa, he gives it open-handedly and generously, that doesn't mean that she has complete and full rights over it in the ways that we've already seen. So if the husband is eating, is enjoying, for example, pere perot, meaning when she gets profits, that profit is put to and is invested and he gets the profits off of that secondary investment, that would seem to mean that he has a connection to this property and therefore he should have the right to say that the creditor, the wife's creditor, shouldn't be able to collect from it. So the Beit Shmuel asks about that. Whereas the Chalkei Machlokei felt that, well, but the fact that the woman, that the wife gets the original profits is the reason why it shows that the creditor couldn't take it. So the Prisha asked that question, and they point us back in the direction of the Rush that was quoted by the Tur. Let's remember the Tur's father was the Rush. So the Tur quotes his father, and the Tur says, "In natan la habal matana, Afilu baal chov shehilva achash, and he said gova mina, which is what the Shulchan Aruch said as well. So let's remember, the tour lived in the early 1300s in Spain. He was a son of the Rush. They had moved from Germany in the early 1300s, then they moved to Spain. And the Rush, when he got to Spain from Germany, became instantly, you know, the giant of the Spanish, the rabbinate. And his son was Rav Yehuda ben Arush. Rav Yaakov ben Arush. Rav Yehuda ben Arush died in the Black Plague of 1348. Rav Yaakov ben Arush was the tour. That's in the mid-1300s. And in the late 1500s, when Rav Yosef Karo came to write his halacha book, he modeled it after the tour. He took the structure of the tour, and by structure I mean what we call the four turim, the four sections of Shulchan Aruch, or Chaim, Evena, Ezer, Choshim Nishpat. That was created, that was an innovation of the tour, and the order of the chapters was in the tour. Shulchan Aruch took that existing format and then put it into clearer paragraphs, and that's what made it an easier work to use, and that's why it became the Shulchan Aruch. But much of the structure of it and the setup of it was by the Tur, who frequently quotes his father, the Rush. So in this case, he's quoting his father, the Rush, as saying that if the husband gives a present to the wife, then a creditor who had lent her after she got married can collect from it. And he says, he then quotes his father is saying, in a tshuva, and the Rav Uziel points out that it is in a tshuva, because the Beis Yosef is going to wonder about it. The Rush had said that if Reuven lent money to Leah, meaning one man lent money to this woman, and he wants to collect it from the gift, so the Rush answered, well, it depends. If it's a gift, if the deed of the gift, if the shtar that created the gift gave it to her fully, then even if the husband is allowed to eat peyrot, it depends on her. As long as it depends on her and it's her choice, and whenever she wants to, she's allowed to remove the husband from it, then you can collect from it. So, because we're bothered by that, Rav Uziel tracks it down to a tshuva in the Rush, what it actually says is that Reuven lent her the land. A husband gave his wife land or money in front of witnesses, and the witnesses said to him, you need to know that when you're giving this gift to her, it's as if you're giving it to a stranger on the road, meaning that whenever she wants to, she'll be able to take it from you, and she'll be able to do whatever she wants with it. And they quote our Gemara that we started with, Batana kanta isha ve'en ha'ba'al ochel peirot, that when a husband gives a gift to the wife, the husband does not get the peirot. And so the malveh, the person who lent the money to this woman, now says, well, since the land is hers, I should be able to take it directly with a, and he quotes another halakhic concept, which is called the Shibuda de Rabbi Natan. Shibuda de Rabbi Natan says that if A owes B money and B owes C money, C can just go to A and collect the money. He doesn't have to go through B. It's not that B does the collecting from A and then turns it over to C, but the C is allowed to eliminate the middleman in that context and therefore go. Here too, the man who lent the money, the person who lent the money to this woman, says, well, the husband gave her a gift and she owes me money, I can take it. And the Rush says, yeah, that's right. So how can that work if we've said before that gifts have limits on them, right? So Rav Uziel says, well, it depends on what's going on. And he points out that there's a Rashba who says that if the husband makes a clear condition when he gives her the gift, and in that condition he says you can sell it or give it, meaning Rabbeinu Tam had said she can't do that. She cannot sell this land or give it, because even though a husband gives a gift generously, he doesn't mean to give it completely fully to her. But the Rashba said, but if he says he did, then that works. So it's not like a rule that this can't happen. It's our assumptions about what the husband is thinking. This brings us back to what I mentioned right at the beginning, that what we're talking about in monetary issues is very often a matter of what we assume is true rather than what might necessarily be true. And the Rashi is saying that. The fact that the Gemara says what it says, and Rabbeinu Tam understands it to mean that the husband means that she can't sell or gift the land to anybody else, the gift to anybody else, that's our assumption. But if the husband in fact said it, then it's going to be different. And so too the Ritva said, if they made a specific condition, whatever condition they made is going to be true. is going to be not just true, but it's going to be applicable. And the example that the Ritva gives is that if they made the condition that she's allowed to sell it or give it away, it will be so much hers that she can give it away in the usual way, but she can also give it away in what's called a matnat shkev mira, right? Just a brief, another halachic concept that's coming up. A matnat shkev mira was, ordinarily to give a gift, there needs some form of an acquisition. This is true in general halacha. For to transfer ownership, there's lots of forms of acquisition, but you have to do one of those forms of acquisition before it's transferred. So if you think about, not such a great example, but if you think about when people want to sell chametz, so they go to their rabbi to appoint the rabbi a shaliach, to appoint the rabbi a messenger to sell their chametz, so they pick up a pen. So that's actually considered, that's meaning to create a kinyan chalipin. So in this case, it's just to transfer the right to sell the chametz, but a kinyan chalipin works in other cases as well, that we can trade objects. So if I do a kinyan, if I do an act of acquisition on one object, the other object of mine goes to you. So if I want to sell you a car and the car's not around, if I take possession of something of yours, the car can transfer and become the other person's as well. So that would be a problem for a person who is not well. If a person is not well and is does not expect to recover from their illness, for them to have to go around and try to do kinyan and try to do acts of acquisition to give their property to all those to whom they want to divide their property, that would be a very difficult thing to do. And the Chazal worried that that would cause mental anguish to the patient and that might adversely affect their health. So therefore, they created an institution called a matnat shkiv mira. A matnat shkiv mira was that if a person is sadly ill and expects to pass away from this illness, they can divide up their assets and give them away if they so choose. And by saying it, that will be sufficient. And matnat shkiv mira is kichtuva misuris, like it's written and given over to them. That's relevant here because the Ritva is saying that if the husband said she can do whatever she wants with the gift that he's giving her, with the land, let's say, that he's giving her, so she can even, according to the Ritva, give it as a matnat shkiv mira, meaning I might have thought that it wouldn't be so much for that it would be included in that kind of property, but the Ritva is saying it is. Therefore, coming back to the Rush, what the Rush was saying was that in his situation, where the man said to the Edim, he said to the witnesses, I want to do an acquisition. I want you to write in Bechol Lashon Shel Zechut, in every language of acquisition that there is. And the witnesses specifically said to him, you need to know if we write it that way, it's like giving it to a complete stranger and it's not going to be yours in any way whatsoever. So there, the Rush is saying, Rav Uziel tells us that there's a specific statement by the husband that he's giving it to her completely, completely, completely. What's interesting about the case to me is that the Gemara they quote, though, is a Gemara that we've seen, meaning it's the Gemara that says that when a husband gives a gift to his wife, he doesn't get the peirot, he doesn't get the profit. We've seen that many Rishonim, many authorities held, that Gemara doesn't mean it quite as fully as these witnesses are taking it. But the Rush is saying, if the witnesses said it that way to the husband and he agreed, even though in some sense they sort of misread that Gemara, because we're saying that Gemara doesn't have to mean that, nonetheless, as they said it that way and he agreed to it, that's the way that it becomes. In other words, like I said before, on monetary issues, including a husband giving a gift to his wife, if he makes a specific condition a certain way, if he makes a specific rule a certain way, that's what's going to be the governing principle of this gift. And it seems like even if he was either misled or misquoted or was said to him in a way that wasn't the only way to see it, if that's what he agreed to, that's what he agreed to. That's as a side topic, that's something to think about in general. There's a value there in knowing what the halakha really is or really is not, because if it's misrepresented to you and you think, well, that's what I got to do, and therefore you go along with it, halakhically that will generally count because you went along with whatever you went along with. So in monetary cases particularly, people need to be careful and to think about or to find out what their actual rights are, what they really need or don't need to know, and what is or isn't the relevant halakha case. Because if we agree to something in halakha, then we agree to it. It's not our issue here, but it's an important side point. I mean, it's our issue here because of the husband and the wife that we're talking about, but it's an important side point to think about. The Gemara, in another case, not relevant to our case at all, says that Talyuha Vizavin, if somebody is coerced into selling something, the sale takes effect. And the Gemara says, that's because we assume that the pressure, whatever it is, was sufficient that the person actually agreed to it. And there's another halakhic principle that if somebody gives a moda before a sale, meaning they go to other people and they say, listen, I'm about to sell something, but I don't really mean it. I'm only doing it because they're forcing me and I don't want it to take effect. That also is valid. So there's a lot of important background information that people might not have. When it comes to monetary issues, the halakha generally assumes that whatever a person actually agrees to, even if there were other issues they could have known about, had somebody told them about it, nonetheless agreement is agreement. That's a broad idea that's relevant here and relevant other places worth knowing. Rav Uziel's point is that when it comes to this Gemara with the husband giving a gift to the wife, the Gemara seems to say that he doesn't get the direct profits right away because he gives it to her generously. Halakhically, that seems to have the ramifications, some ramifications of he doesn't get the direct profits, but we seem to assume that doesn't mean to say he gives it to her completely such that she could sell it or gift it to somebody else. And it doesn't even mean that she can use the profits right away. It seems to mean that we sort of put the profits in escrow for her or in some kind of an investment property for her, and that during the course of the marriage, the profits from that investment property will become his, and we'll keep doing that throughout the marriage. That's what it seems to say. But if, and you can easily imagine why a wife getting a gift wouldn't want it that way because it becomes very complicated. If the husband specifically says that he's giving it to her more than that, he's giving it to her more fully, so the Rashba says he gives her the right to sell it. The Ritva says he gives her the right to sell it, and then she can do it even with a matnat shkimira. And the Rosh's case was the witnesses say explicitly as they're writing the deed, know that this makes it completely hers such that a third party can take it, meaning you can easily imagine a husband giving a gift to a wife and wanting her to be able to sell it or give it to somebody else, but not wanting it to just immediately go to an outstanding loan, right? Let's say it happens today that a man gets married to a woman, finds out she has credit card debt that he hadn't realized about. He doesn't necessarily want to have this gift that he's giving her just go to her credit card debt. You can easily imagine that. But the Rosh has said that to the extent that he gives it to her fully, and the witnesses say you need to know it's completely hers and you will have no connection to it, no say over it, and he agrees, then Shibudah de Rav Natan comes into play. Then the whole issue of this A owing B, B owing C, therefore C being able to collect from A, comes into play. All that is background. Quickly, Rav Uziel now comes back to our case, because in our case, it's unclear what the gift was, how the gift was given. He says, if the gift was given with an ordinary legal deed of transfer of sale, meaning a British government deed transferring the property, right? And in those deeds, whoever holds the deed to the property is the complete owner of it. So in that situation, if that's what happened, he says he thinks that the wife is right, that this is given to her as a full gift, it's hers now completely, and the husband has no relevance to it. And if that's true, then the separate requirement of the divorce that he support her has nothing, is no connection to this land that he gave her. But if he gave it to her just with a deed of gift, like a handwritten Jewish deed, saying, I gift this to you, so there in halacha, we generally assume that in the course of a marriage, if a husband just gives a gift to his wife, he doesn't mean to give it completely fully that it's hers without any connection to him. He means to give it with some limitations, as we've seen at length, as we've seen, if there are limitations on sale, limitations on what are done with the profits, and things like that. If that's true, in that situation, then one of the limitations would be that if they get divorced, he can now say, well, now I only meant to give it to you for the duration of the marriage in that sense, and now that you have it here for after the marriage, that can be the support for you. So those are the answers that Rav Uziel gives to this question. The specific question, and the couple are no longer around for us, this is from, you know, many, many years ago, that doesn't matter to us so much, but what I find interesting are the underlying issues of gift giving in a marriage, outside of a marriage, what conditions we do and don't assume, and how we work it out when people have a dispute about what happened and what was made explicit, what wasn't made explicit, and what are halakhic assumptions. In our case, the halakhic assumption of a gift in a marriage is that a husband means it generously, but not necessarily completely, unless he says so. And that'll always be a question of, did he say so or did he not say so? For Rav Uziel, signing a British deed, which just gives full property to whoever bears the deed, would mean it was a complete gift and it's hers completely. Other than that, we would go with the Gemara's assumptions, which were that when a husband gives a gift to his wife, he gives it perhaps more than ordinary property, but not such that he's completely removed from it. And that is our discussion for the 9th of Sivan, Rav Uziel, on gifts that a husband gives to a wife. Have a good day.